Good evening. I'm Leland Vitter. There is genuinely good news in America tonight. News, plural. A new drug from Pfizer promises to all but eliminate the chance of dying from COVID. The economy added 500,000 new jobs, pushing the unemployment rate down below 5%, and your 401k is likely at or near an all-time high. These are all worth celebrating. Here's President Biden doing that earlier today.
In total, the job creation in the first full 9 months of my administration is about 5.6 million new jobs, a record for any new president.
So let's talk about your day tomorrow. You get up to have breakfast with the family. Every single item on the breakfast table costs more than it did a year ago. Eggs up, bread up, coffee up, bacon up. If we get closer to the monitor, we'll actually be able to see by how much. Bacon is up almost 20%. Now, you get into your car. Gas is up 50% from this time last year. A year ago is important because America was then energy independent. Since then, President Biden canceled the Keystone XL pipeline and allowed the Russians to corner Europe's energy market. He also de-incentivized American oil exploration and production. Here is his energy secretary this morning explaining what America can do about it.
What is the Granholm plan to increase oil production in America?
Oh, my God. That is hilarious. Would that I had the magic wand on this.
She and the president actually kind of do have a magic wand on this, but we'll move on from that to energy prices. They're going up as well. It's going to cost 30% more to heat your home this winter if you use natural gas. If you're using electric, it's only 6%. Thanksgiving dinner will cost a lot more as well. Turkey's up 27%, pumpkin pie 17%, potatoes are up 13%, carrots are up 47%. A lot of that has to do with the transportation costs, and transportation costs are up because of gas prices. Plus, there's the pesky problem of empty shelves and shipping costs that are through the roof, but those are solvable. So that's where we are at. Low unemployment, record high stock market, the pandemic nearly in the rearview mirror, along with the highest inflation since Jimmy Carter's economic policies. And today, the president proposed a solution to that. Spend more money.
The second way to make sure recovery is fully felt is to pass my bipartisan infrastructure agreement and my Build Back Better plan.
It's very simple. Pump a couple of extra $1 trillion into the economy and inflation rises. Everything we buy will cost more, and there is zero chance wages rise fast enough to pay for it. But the president thinks he can, quite literally, repeal the laws of economics.
It will ease the financial burden of inflation for middle-class families. Put another way, these bills will provide families with, as my dad used to say, just a little more breathing room.
As we speak, congressional Democrats are playing a very expensive game of legislative chicken because in a Friday afternoon showdown, progressives in the House of Representatives are threatening to vote down one of the president's key bills that he just talked about right there. Kelly Meyer, live on Capitol Hill with the latest. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Leland. Well, progressive Democrats are now holed up in a nearly three-hour-long meeting trying to decide what card they want to play next here. All along, they have said that they won't vote for this bipartisan infrastructure package unless it is tied to the big social spending bill. Moderate Democrats saying today they won't vote for the spending bill until they find out how much it costs. So that's what brings us to where we are at now. We know President Biden is now trying to whip votes here, calling into a congressional progressive caucus meeting, trying to get them on board, saying, hey, we are going to have a vote on this spending bill, but we really need you to vote for this bipartisan infrastructure package tonight. They are really trying to get a win here after a big loss this week in Virginia, trying to show that they could do something. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is still pushing ahead, trying to get a vote on this $1.2 trillion infrastructure package for tonight. That's why we all are still here waiting to see what happens next. But really, the power is inside that meeting, in the Progressive Caucus meeting right now, as they decide what steps to take next here.
Kelly, as you talk to folks on Capitol Hill, how surprised are they that Nancy Pelosi, the greatest vote whipper perhaps in history, certainly since Tip O'Neill, would think about putting something on the floor as she did this morning and not have the votes as evidenced by what's happening right now.
And that's why you see them waiting here, because she won't put that final bipartisan infrastructure package vote on the floor until she knows that she has that shored up. And I think that's what she's saying. We're going to stay till as long as it takes through the night. They're trying to whip up these votes with progressive Democrats and get them on board. They know they wouldn't get enough votes from Republicans on this, maybe only a few. That's what Republican leader Kevin McCarthy was saying earlier today. So she is not putting that bipartisan infrastructure package on the floor until she knows she has the votes. This procedural vote earlier was on that rules vote on the BBB. On the spending bill. That actually right now is making history as the second longest vote in congressional history, I believe, because it's been going on since about 3:30 this afternoon. But everything is on hold here, basically waiting to see what steps the Progressive Caucus takes next here. Leland?
Yeah, we think about what's in the bill that they're voting on or would be voting on tonight if they think they have the votes. It's the infrastructure bill. So one of the big things they're talking about is broadband internet. There's ports. There's roads and the like. The House Democratic majority's three votes or so. If you've got 15 or 20 progressives who hold the line and don't vote for it, the thing dies. What are you hearing from those 9 or 10 Republicans who've talked about crossing over?
You know, there are a few Republicans who are supporting this right now, the bipartisan infrastructure plan. We know this plan did pass in the Senate already with some Republican support. There are things in this that they do support. There is a little bit of green energy in this as well, with about $15 billion going towards electric vehicles and charging stations and the like. But there is some support there, but just not enough to get it across the finish line here without some progressive Democrats on board. And it is this kind of game of chicken, as you were saying, and this puzzle of trying to get everyone together. And now it's going into the night, Friday night here in Washington. They are saying, as far as we know, we are sticking around to see if they make this happen. And we know the president is really engaged tonight trying to get this across the finish line, really trying to show that his administration can get something done.
Yeah, well, they seem to think that's why they lost the elections in Virginia, was because they haven't gotten anything done. So we'll see if this motivates them. Kelly, thank you. Stand by. We'll come back to you as news warrants. Kelly was just talking about all the money for green energy in the small bill. There's a whole lot more for the climate in the big bill, about $550 billion in President Biden's Build Back Better. And it's been a rough week for one U.S. senator who doesn't follow the traditional groupthink on climate change. That's Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia. He faced a mob that followed him into a parking garage and then blocked his car.
We want to live! We want to live! We want to live!
It appears they genuinely believe they will die because of climate change. Current data, though, just doesn't support that. As published in the Wall Street Journal, worldwide climate-related disasters kill ever fewer. In 2021, climate disasters killed roughly 1/100th the number of people they did in the 1920s and 1/10th the number they did in the 1980s. In 2019, 408 Americans died from weather conditions and storms. Again, that's 1/100th the number that died from flu and pneumonia. That was 47,783. So remember those guys chanting, "We want to live." Yes, it's possible to die in a climate change-fueled hurricane, but it's kind of unlikely. To be clear, we are not saying climate change isn't real. The climate's been changing since Earth formed, but let's keep it in perspective. The big bill to be passed by the House includes $500 billion to deal with climate change for things like electric school buses and $12,500 for middle-class families to buy electric cars. Jason Nichols, senior lecturer at the University of Maryland, joins us now for a study in progressive politics. Jason, I always appreciate people wanting to have a greener planet, but is there any evidence that this $550 billion is going to make it so the Earth doesn't get warmer?
Well, I think that there are many things that we can do to stop from getting to a point where we lose more lives. I think I read a study that basically said that between 2030 2030 and 2050, it's expected that globally we're going to lose about 250,000 people every year to climate-related disasters. And the thing is, the American people care about things like immigration. They care about viruses and pandemics. And those things are exacerbated.
Hold on, hold on. I'm glad you brought up pandemics, because there's $550 billion for climate change, sure, which climate-related disasters killed in the U.S. less than 500 people. Okay, there's only $3 billion in this bill for pandemic preparedness, and the coronavirus just killed 700,000 Americans. How does that make sense?
Exactly. So let's talk about that, Leland. First of all, luckily, or we're blessed to be at a time when we have things like vaccines, and we also, now there are drugs from Pfizer and Merck that are going to keep people out of the hospital and keep people safe. It seems like there's no other variant of the coronavirus, of COVID, that is ravaging another country. So it seems like we're coming out on the other end of that. But what we do know about climate is that rising temperatures cause people with respiratory illnesses to get sicker. So if there were another pandemic, God forbid, you know, within the next 100 years or so, it would get worse if the earth were warmer.
Jason, I admire the stretch, really. But come on, are we really saying that the way to save lives during a pandemic is to spend $500 billion to make the world half a degree cooler?
Leland, what I said was, what's going to save lives with a pandemic is science and getting
vaccines. Shouldn't we spend $550 billion on that, not on climate?
Trust me, I believe that there's probably more money going into R&D for drugs and for illnesses, many of them across the board. I think we have not paid attention to climate, and so we need to pay closer attention to it. And I think that having electric buses for our children, so that they're not breathing in. Have you been in an inner city? I don't know. You're in Chicago. Yeah. Maybe go to the south side of Chicago and see what the air quality is like. And I think you'll probably agree with me.
Well, you know, the diesel fume thing is actually a legitimate point, and it's an interesting one, too. We'll put aside the air pollution created by the producing the electricity for the electric school buses, but never mind. This is an interesting point, an inflection point, though, that we seem to be in this climate issue. Of all people, Greta Thunberg was at the Glasgow Climate Summit, where President Biden just was, had this to say.
We don't need any more distant, non-binding pledges. We don't need any more empty promises. We don't need any more commitments that are full of loopholes and incomplete statistics and that ignore the historical emissions and climate justice.
She said basically that the Glasgow summit was a PR stunt, which reasonable people can agree happens to be true. But she also makes a very good point. None of the commitments that are coming out of this stuff, and certainly none of the commitments from Russia or China, are binding. So they're the biggest polluters. Why spend $500 billion that we don't have when China and Russia are way, way, way outweighing any reductions in fossil fuel emissions that the U.S. does?
Well, I think it is important to get them to the table and try to get them to commit. It seems like we are getting something from them, but as Greta Thunberg stated, it's non-binding, and there is, you know, there are lots of loopholes there. But I think it's important to get them on the record. And to get them saying, look, this is what we're going to do. This is the timeline that we're working with. The United States still has to do its part. The United States is a leader in the world, and we have to do our part to better the planet. And so that doesn't mean that we do nothing because they're doing something. They're not doing what they need to do. We are the people who do the things that are need to be done to make the planet better. We've always done that, and we need to continue.
That does speak to American exceptionalism. The prompter right now, Jason, says, gentlemen, thank you both. That's from when we normally have your partner in crime, Chris Hahn, with you here for the panel. He's off this Friday at his daughter's soccer tournament. We wish her good luck in the tournament, and we'll see you fellas next week, all right?
Absolutely.
Good to see you, Professor. Glenn Youngkin won Virginia with Trump policies, but without Trump's personality. Is MAGA Lite the new way to win? And states are suing the Biden administration over vaccine mandates. Two of the attorney generals leading that charge. Why they think they can take on the feds.
I think the availability of therapeutics like this that could be used to help people who have breakthrough infections, people who don't respond well to vaccination, the small number of people who have decided to forego vaccination. I think the bottom line is the end of the pandemic, at least as it relates to the United States, is in sight right now, given all the tools we have to combat this disease.
Hard to get better news than that, right? Former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb talking about Pfizer's new experimental COVID drug, which he says could end the pandemic. The news of this antiviral comes as states challenge President Biden's new vaccine and testing mandate, which requires businesses with more than 100 employees to make sure their workers are either vaccinated or pay for them to be tested weekly. It goes into effect January 4th. About a dozen states have filed lawsuits against the mandate, among them Missouri. We're joined by Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt. Good to see you, sir. We appreciate it. All right, so is the argument that vaccine mandates in general are illegal, or just that the federal government can't do it this way?
Yeah, the federal government has no authority. It's unprecedented. It's breathtaking in scope. It's unconstitutional. There's no statutory authority for it. And it's unwise. The federal government is supposed to be a government of limited powers. The states created the federal government and gave them enumerated powers. This isn't one of them. OSHA has no authority under the Constitution or under the statutes to promulgate a rule like this that would force the vaccination of tens of millions of Americans.
So we think about what's going on in Missouri right now. Missouri vaccination rates, at least one dose, 57.1%, fully vaccinated, 49.9%, so about half of the state. If an employer in Missouri, I won't name any of my friends in Missouri, but if an employer in the great state of Missouri said to their employees, look, you need to be vaccinated, you don't have a problem with that?
Well, I do personally, but there's a different analysis. I think that this is—
How about this? You wouldn't sue them for that?
Well, there's not a state law that would allow me to go do that.
Okay.
But right now, when the federal government is moving forward on it, like we filed a lawsuit last week on the federal contractor mandate. Missouri's in the lead on that. Missouri's in the lead now. We're the lead plaintiff on this lawsuit today on the private employer mandate. So again, this has to do with what powers does the federal government have? And do we want to live in a country, by the way, that emergency order after emergency order gives one person or one administration this much power over people's lives? And I think the answer to that is no. I don't want to live in that kind of biomedical security state. This country's been the freest country in the history of the world, and we need to defend that.
So let me ask you this way, and we've talked about this a lot on the show. If President Biden was really serious about a federal vaccine mandate, he could do things like, say, if you want to fly on a U.S. air carrier, there would be a vaccine mandate, on and on and on. Are you upset about what he's done, or is it simply how he's done it has opened the door and allowed you all to sue because of the OSHA rule?
All of the above. I think people should be able to make these decisions themselves. Okay, as a general proposition, just like I don't believe in the forced masking of five-year-olds at school, right? I think that in and of itself is unwise. It's not based on science, that particular issue, right? However, I don't think the federal government has any authority, any constitutional authority or statutory authority to do any of this. And they're making it up as they go along. And again, this is a dangerous precedent to set, to allow governments to take this much power, because guess what? People don't get it back. This is the pathway to tyranny has been paved with emergency orders for a very, very long time. And this is America. This isn't some banana republic. And
you make a very good point that we the people never get those rights back. Aaron Rodgers, Super Bowl champion, I believe, certainly MVP one time or another, with the Green Bay Packers quarterback, tested positive for COVID. He was not vaccinated. And then he said this about the vaccine debate. Take a listen.
And health should not be political. When Trump in 2020 was championing these vaccines that were coming so quick, what did the left say? And I'm talking about every member of the left. Don't trust the vaccine. Don't get the vaccine. You're going to die from the vaccine.
Kamala Harris said that as well. This would be the question. If Scott Gottlieb is right, that these antiviral drugs basically mean that COVID is in the rearview mirror, you're not going to die from it. Does that play into your all's lawsuit?
Well, not really, because the underlying issue here is that the federal government doesn't have authority no matter what, right? Whether we're peaking or it's decreasing, all of those factors aside, the federal government just does not have the authority.
I just got to interrupt you for 1 second, because there's the every time I have a Democratic attorney general or lawyer on here, they said there's that case from the early 1900s in the Supreme Court, Massachusetts, where the federal government in a health emergency can do virtually anything and make you get a shot. So I'm not going to argue law with you, but please explain.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll address that directly. That didn't involve the federal government. That was a state. And by the way, that case also was used as a pretext for forced sterilization of individuals with disabilities. So the courts have backed away from that. So I'm not sure they want to rely on it because it's not relevant. So I'm happy to address that because it's not relevant in this case. The federal government doesn't have the power to do it, plain and simple.
Interesting.
And I also think people are tired of it, Leland. You heard Aaron Rodgers there. People are tired of being told what to do all the time by the federal government. These COVID Karens, you know, people who want to live in COVID stand forever. Enough is enough. Americans want their country back, and that's what we're fighting for.
Well, you've been at the forefront, no question about that, whether it was the mask mandates, the vaccine mandates now, and the shutdown orders. You've been at the very forefront of the fight. We always appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it. And as this lawsuit continues ahead of January 4th, keep us updated, all right, sir?
We'll do it. Thanks, Leland.
Thank you. The left is now attacking the Republican who became the first black woman elected to statewide office, even calling her a voice for white supremacists. Reaction ahead.
My name is Winsome Sears, and I served in the United States Marine Corps. I was the first Republican to win a seat in the House of Delegates in a majority black district since 1865.
There is a black mouth moving, but a white idea through the running on the runway of the tongue of a figure who justifies and legitimates the white supremacist practices.
Hmm. That's about par for the course on CNN and MSNBC. Their commentators do not think much of Virginia's first black woman elected to statewide office, who happens to be a Republican. Winsome Sears is now the lieutenant governor-elect, an opponent of critical race theory. This is the left accuses Virginia voters of racism after their stunning losses in an election previously seen as widely safe for Democrats. Joining us now, Robert Petillo, civil rights attorney, LaDainius Johnson, host of Informed Dissent. Gentlemen, appreciate you being with us. Robert, first to you. You've been outspoken on this. I'm interested in your thoughts.
Oh, well, you know, I think Democrats often use this as a crutch when it comes to campaign season, that at the last minute, they always switch back to racism because Republicans, one, make it very easy to do. But two, if you think about what Democrats campaigned on in 2020, they were talked about the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, the For the People Act, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. There were conversations about whether or not they would have a vote on H.R. 4, the Study Commission on Reparations. We saw what happened to Haitian immigrants at the border. So they campaigned on all these things. And then when they don't come through on those issues, they still have to find a way to motivate black voters to come to the polls. Mm-hmm. So that normally is by pushing this concept that the other side is racist. The reason I say the other side makes it easy is, let's use the Haitian migrant situation. You had Joe Biden's Border Patrol chasing black people down on horseback. And instead of Republicans just capitalizing on that and saying, look, we are on the side of the migrants, we think this is improper, you had Donald Trump come out and say, well, all the Haitians had AIDS, so they should have been pushed back into the to see in the first place.
Yeah,
so
there's that old.
Republicans aren't helping and Democrats aren't helping.
Yeah, there's that great old line that we used to use in the Middle East, never miss an opportunity, miss an opportunity. Leonidas, after the 2020 elections, liberal commentators spent weeks salivating over intersectionality, right? The first Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, person of this, the first whatever, three or four different intersectional things. Are we to now believe that diversity should only be celebrated if the person is liberal? Is that the message?
That is absolutely the message. And we saw it with Joy Reid and Michael Eric Dyson. The minute you stray from the narrative, doesn't matter if you're black, white, brown, they're going to attack you. All the diversity, equity, inclusion, that goes out of the window immediately as soon as you go against the liberal dogma and the progressive ideology. And I look at somebody like Winsome Sears, who is she said, she's the American dream. And she's black, she's a woman, she's an immigrant. I mean, Democrats, if they stuck to their ideology, they should be lifting her up on a pedestal. They should be building monuments to her. They should be singing her praises. But instead, we're getting this idea that she is a mouthpiece of white supremacy. And listen, Leland, all it is, I don't even think that they believe what they're saying. I think that it's just emotional manipulation. I think that they know.
That's sort of what Robert, that's kind of what the theme Robert said, is that it's right. A crutch and they don't have anything else to go back to. Robert, this is, as much as I can tell, Democrats' excuses for the Virginia losses. It was Terry's fault, saying Terry McAuliffe was a terrible candidate. He was. I covered him, but there you go. Congress didn't do enough, saying if only they had acted and passed more of the president's agenda, then things would be fine. And the last one is Virginia voters are racist. Focusing on the last one, Virginia voters are racist. Is calling 52% of a state and considering that Youngkin won a big part of the Latino vote. Are calling those folks racist really a way to win friends and influence people?
Absolutely not. And it's lazy. And let's understand, math is a thing. And the good thing about math is it's unbiased. It has its own facts. Youngkin's got about 300,000 fewer votes than Donald Trump got a year ago. So it's not as if there was just a sudden surge to the Republican side of the aisle. The issue was that Terry McAuliffe got about 800,000 fewer votes than Joe Biden. And the reasons for this are, let's go back 2 years to when the Democratic Party of Virginia decided to smear Justin Fairfax. And instead of allowing Ralph Northam and his blackface to step down, and Justin Fairfax, a young African-American lieutenant governor, to step in and govern the state for 2 years, and he would have won this race in a layup, they decided to stand behind Ralph Northam, circulate a lie that Justin Fairfax had committed sexual assault. He spent 2 years clearing his name. The problem we have in this country is even after you clear your name, there's no way to get your reputation back. And because of that, they were able to slide Terry McAuliffe back in as the nominee, someone that nobody wanted, that has no enthusiasm, and that is a relic and a throwback to the 1990s and the triangulation of the Clinton administration, and then try to cram that down black voters' throats as if they would forget what you just did to Justin Fairfax. So Democrats are going to have to do an autopsy of this and realize you cannot simply just show up in the black community 2 weeks before the election, have a fish fry, bring in Stacey Abrams, and think you're going to get the black vote. This is a new generation of voters who are not going to fall for the same okey-doke again.
You know, Robert, somebody could mistake you after that answer for a Republican. We won't let anybody think that, but it's possible that somebody could think that. Leonidas, how do Republicans capitalize on this and not miss the opportunity to miss the opportunity that Robert laid out?
Yeah, I mean, it's just they just have to get away from any identity politics. Don't fall into the trap. Don't play the identity politics game, because Democrats are going to try to suck you into the intersectionality trap and try to get you to play the race game and play the gender game, play the transgender game. And you just got to push back on that. I think what Republicans actually really need to do is do what Youngkin did, is focus on the cultural stuff, focus on what people care about, focus on education, focus on traditional values, focus on what people in these communities actually really care about, instead of playing these identity politics games. And that's what Youngkin did, and I think that's why he was so effective in Virginia.
Yeah, he certainly was. There's also perhaps some questions to be learned for President Trump. We're going to get into that next. Gentlemen, great conversation. We're going to have you both back, all right? Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Lena.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Democrats are digging in after Virginia. We just talked about that. Former President Trump not changing his style, saying Glenn Youngkin would have lost by 15 points without his MAGA base coming out. This despite the fact that Youngkin beat President Trump's margins in red areas, in deep Trump areas, and also flipped suburban voters, namely white women who shunned President Trump in 2020. Columnist Rich Laurie writes, there is no doubt that Trump brought a new cultural combativeness to the GOP, sensed a hunger among the party's voters for new departures on immigration and trade, but Trump has lived off the legend of 2016, only he knows how to win or fight. Niall Standage, White House columnist for The Hill, our sister company, obviously covered President Trump during his time in the White House and joins us now. All right, Niall, any chance President Trump moderates?
No, is the short answer. Look, I mean, for a start, President Trump's a 75-year-old man. I don't know about you, Leland, but I don't know many 75-year-old men or women who decide to turn over a new leaf personality-wise at that point in their life. But secondly, you know, President Trump believes that what he did in the 2016 campaign, which you just mentioned, worked for him, and to the extent of winning an election, it obviously did. The problem comes whenever there are a significant number of voters who just won't vote for him because of his approach, because of his demeanor, because of his language and the way he treats critics. And all of that is a genuine political problem for him.
Yeah, you think about this, that you and I discussed the Virginia race in depth. I spent a little bit of time reporting there. Glenn Youngkin is MAGA without the crazy. He's not some milquetoast George W. Bush-esque conservative.
Absolutely right. And he's not really an anti-Trump conservative. I mean, I think that's an important point to make. As you pointed out in your introduction, Leland, he was able to actually get just as much support in rural conservative Southwest Virginia, while at the same time boosting his support in the Northern Virginia suburbs, suburbs of other cities around the state. So I think that that was really important. He was able to retain the support of the Trump voters and add to it. The part of addition was always the problem for President Trump. I think President Trump preferred the adulation of his base to the addition of new people beyond that base.
All right. Speaking of that addition, you're in front of the Capitol right now. Go 16 blocks up Pennsylvania Avenue. How worried is the Biden administration about the ability of a candidate to do that addition?
There is real concern about that. Clearly, President Biden's approval ratings have fallen significantly in the past few months. He's vulnerable coming up for re-election. He will be into his 80s by the time of the next election. There's a really perhaps peculiar fact of American politics. The White House and a lot of Democrats would prefer to run against former President Trump than many other Republicans, because they think that Trump is such a divisive figure. He produces turnout for Democrats as much as he produces turnout for Republicans. The fear is of a Glenn Youngkin type figure. I'm not saying Mr. Youngkin himself, he only just got elected, but of a Youngkin type figure.
I'm going to interrupt you. I was going to say, a Glenn Youngkin type, why not Glenn Youngkin? I've already started seeing and hearing from Republican donors and operatives that that is a, if not a plan, at least a thought.
Yeah, I think you're a bit of an advocate for the Youngkin 2024 boom.
I just want to cover it.
It is a possibility. I mean, there is clearly something that he has done very impressive in Virginia that we're just discussing. The fact that he was able to turn a state that voted by 10 points for candidate Biden, as he was, to a Republican governorship, that's a significant political achievement. And it's one that certainly the rest of the party is looking at with interest.
Hey, Niall, awesome reporting as always. It's been a long week. We sure appreciate you staying up late with us on a number of nights. We're better for it and smarter for it.
Thanks, Leland. Take care.
All right. Americans are fleeing as cartels are taking over small towns in Southern California. Jorge Ventura on his new documentary, Cartelville, what the cartels control and why it matters everywhere in America. The game of chicken continues on Capitol Hill, where progressives still won't agree to vote for President Biden's infrastructure bill until they have an agreement on the much larger Build Back Better plan. There is a scenario where a few Republicans come to rescue House Speaker Nancy Pelosi from the progressives. That looks unlikely. Texas Congressman Andy Biggs will not be among them and joins us now. Congressman, good to see you. We appreciate it. I know you're up on Capitol Hill. Republicans got the popcorn out and just enjoying the show?
Yeah, pretty much. We've been sitting here for the last 3.5 hours watching them be unable to even close down a motion that asked for a Congressional Budget Office score on their bills. And they can't even close that up, which tells you that they're a long way from getting the votes to do anything tonight, Leland.
Is there a chance that some Republicans come and rescue the speaker on this one?
There won't be any Republicans on the Build Back plan. The infrastructure, you might see a few, but there's so many Democrats talking about staying off of that. I don't know that there'd be enough Republicans to actually carry that across the finish line right now either.
I'm thinking about how this is playing back in Arizona, your home state. The bipartisan infrastructure deal, you get broadband, there's highways, there's, you don't have any ports, but you got airports there that need new gates as this country grows and the city and state of Arizona grows. You think that at least that would be somewhat popular, no?
Yeah, but right now there are three other bills that do it without all of the additional baggage that the package that the Democrats have put together have. They've kind of linked these two bills, and Leland, they're just massive and overwhelming. And there are three bills out there right now that if they introduced them, I think you'd get just an incredible bipartisan support. But they won't let those go forward because they don't have the additional policy package that the Democrats want.
Play a little game of prediction and what if here. If this does not go through tonight and Nancy Pelosi's, I think this is the fourth or fifth time we've been here on Friday night saying we think we have a vote, we think we have a deal. If it fails, what happens?
I think what happens is they sit back and get that Congressional Budget Office score, and then they also tell us that we have a 72-hour window to get back. So what they'll do is when they get that score, they'll say, come on back. And as soon as they get the votes totally lined up, no more fake votes, then they bring us in and we do it, and they give us a couple days' notice to take a look at the bills.
Gotcha. Congressman Biggs of the great state of Arizona, we're glad to have you, sir. Appreciate you staying late on a Friday night to chat with us.
Absolutely, Lynn. Take care.
Good to see you.
New Mexican cartel-related operations that have exploded in the Antelope Valley.
It doesn't stop.
We're 300 miles away from the border, and we have one of the largest illegal drug operations happening in the backyard in the high deserts of Los Angeles.
It's accelerating to the degree that we're just...
This looks like a video game. This isn't a video game. This is real. Those are assault weapons.
I mean, they are way ahead of us.
Some scary stuff, some great reporting. It's a clip from a new documentary, Cartelville USA, made by our friend Jorge Ventura, reporter for the Daily Caller. It focuses on Mexican drug cartels starting illegal marijuana operations in Southern California and their effects on Americans across the country. Jorge with us now. Congratulations, incredible work. What was the most surprising thing about making this? What was the scariest?
I would say, Leland, the most surprising was just seeing the amount of human smuggling and human trafficking that we are seeing connected to these illegal marijuana grows. And that right there is the consequences of just having a weak border, because now we're seeing towns in Southern California like the Antelope Valley, Acton, East Lancaster, which are 300 miles away from the border, have a human smuggling trafficking problem. So that was one of the more alarming surprises. You're going to see in the documentary, we go embedded with San Bernardino County Sheriff's, where they raid these grows connected to the Chinese mafia with Chinese nationals that were human smuggled and forced to work these grows. So we're seeing real life labor trafficking. But the most, I would say, scariest part was just seeing the amount of weapons and how brazen these operations are in the wide open, in the deserts. LA County right now has over 500 illegal marijuana operations, and these are all connected to criminal fractions.
Incredible access you got. Was this with law enforcement? Was this with state law enforcement, federal? How'd it work?
So we did, we went a couple of days in bed with San Bernardino County Sheriff's, but the rest, Leland, it was just us on our own. We had to get a little spy drone, and we would fly that over the drug operations. We would document the drug cartel activity, whether it's with the water theft, the environment problem, but the human smuggling and the weapons. So we would go out day and night in these communities and just document what was happening in real time. And like I said, you go out there in the deserts, it's shocking just to see these huge, large operations. One of the larger operations that we discovered, Leland, in our reporting was in Phelan, which is near San Bernardino County, where we discovered an operation that was 10 acres long. We're talking about over $1 million worth of drug product, and on that same operation, we have migrants are being forced to work. So the operation was so big, you would have thought Jeff Bezos and Amazon were running it.
That's pretty stunning. 10 acres is big. Border crisis combined with this, and you've obviously spent an incredible amount of time on the border, total encounters by the Border Patrol were now at 1.515 million, 283,000 folks released, 95,000 notices to appear. Connect the crisis on the border that you've reported on and the documentary of the cartels growing marijuana.
So what we're seeing, Leland, is when these migrants or unaccompanied minors, they get released into the U.S., the government is actually losing track of. So Axios actually put out a report in September saying one out of three unaccompanied children released into the U.S., the government loses track of. The situation got so bad that the DOJ, Department of Justice, is in running an investigation on the government to see if we are releasing unaccompanied minors to labor traffickers. And that's what we saw with our own eyes operating and documenting what was going on with these illegal marijuana grows, where these minors, these teens, these women are essentially forced to work these marijuana grows, and they're armed with weapons as well, because there's other cartels that they're battling for territory. And the people who are stuck in the middle of this are just regular working class citizens that, you know, the reason they moved to the desert is to go, is to get away from the crime, is to raise their families in a peaceful town that's not, you know, like a big city like Los Angeles. But now they literally have drug cartels living in their own backyard.
Yeah, and I can imagine some of these cartels are as well armed, if not better armed, than local law enforcement. Certainly better armed than just your regular everyday street cop, and far more ruthless. You keep talking about marijuana. I thought marijuana was legal in California.
Well, Lilian, marijuana is. So the big, kind of the big problem and what opened the floodgates to these black market cartel activity is that in 2016, when Prop 64 passed, it legalized cannabis statewide. But another thing that Prop 64 did is it made illegal cultivation of marijuana plants from a misdemeanor, well, from a felony, and downgraded to a misdemeanor. So now when these cartels, let's say they get raided by LA County sheriffs, if the sheriff can't find any weapons or human smuggling connected to the grow operation, then they're just going to get hit with a $500 fine. So for these cartels, it's almost like the risk is so low, why would they not do it? They see no jail time if they're even caught. I mean, they're making millions of dollars. A $500 ticket, a misdemeanor, isn't going to stop that. So we're hoping that with this documentary, it opens up Californians' eyes, because a big thing is there's a huge misconception problem right now. You know, when people think illegal marijuana, they just shrug their shoulders and say, hey, it's not a big deal. It's probably just two hippie guys, a Cheech and Chong, just growing weed in the middle of the desert. They have no idea that it's tonight to this huge criminal element, but it's the human trafficking and the violence that these cartels bring with them.
And when you say cartels, these are the same cartels that are operating in Mexico that are bringing up heroin and cocaine, and then who own the U.S.-Mexico border for bringing migrants across.
Exactly, Leland. So with the Mexican drug cartels, we're seeing that it has a connection back to Sinaloa. And one of the more shocking things is that these drug cartels, you know, they would, I mean, they still do this, but they would grow their drugs in Mexico and smuggle them through the border. I mean, now they could just grow that product on American soil. But we're also seeing it with the Chinese mafia. You know, Chinese mafia goes into Mexico, they make fentanyl, and they smuggle it through the border. But now the Chinese mafia is smuggling Chinese nationals through the border and forcing these Chinese nationals to work these grow operations.
Scary, scary thing to end on. Cartelville USA, Jorge Ventura, great work. Have an awesome weekend. We'll see you Monday.